and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, Dr. Preston Jones, professor of history at John Brown University, puts a century of growth and progress into perspective with his presentation, Anchorage in 1915, Its Founding and Significance to the World. This talk was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on July 9th and was hosted by the Cook Inlet Historical Society. PowerPoint slides are referenced throughout the presentation, which we've provided a link to on our website, alaskapublic.org. And now, Anchorage in 1915.
Thank you very much. I'm keenly aware that there are a lot of people in the crowd who know more about the history of Anchorage and the history of Alaska than I do. And people ask me what I write about. And I don't only write about Alaska, but I tell them that I write about Alaska, but I don't really write about Alaska. It is Alaska that I write about, but not really. Here's what I mean. Is that my interest is really this whole area. And there's still a question. There's a question that seemed to be resolved for a while, but it's back on the table now, and that is which powers are going to be dominant in the Pacific. And of course, we're hearing a lot about China these days out in East Asia. And that's what interests me. And so when I think of Alaska in the late 1800s and the early 20th century, I'm also thinking of Hawaii. I'm thinking of Guam, I'm thinking of the Philippines, I'm thinking of the Panama Canal, thinking of San Francisco. And then, of course, the British Empire also in British Columbia, and the British have other territories in the Pacific. And then, of course, Japan is a rising power. And so I'm interested in how that plays out, these different empires. And the relationship between them. And I'm working on a book right now that focuses on the American Empire and the British Empire in the far Pacific Northwest. I'll be in the Yukon soon researching that. So my interest is in how broad themes play out in particular places. And so I write about Nome, for example, but not so much a town history. I'm interested in how big themes played out in Nome, and I think the same thing applies to the book on Anchorage. So I'll move quickly through what we have here, but I hope not too quickly. I think most of us know that Anchorage starts out as a railroad town. We don't need to say much about that. But the government wants to build a railroad. Many of us also know that there was some discussion about the name. I don't think there's ever much of a chance that the place would ever be called anything but Anchorage, but there was some discussion about that. Some people referred to it as the Anchorage. But obviously, Anchorage is what it was called at the beginning, and the name stuck. And it strikes me that although 100 years is a long time ago, there are probably a few people living in Anchorage today who were alive when this city was founded, right? And if you think about it that way, you realize that although 100 years is a long time, on the other hand, there are some people who live longer. And there are a few people, probably in Anchorage, who have been alive longer than the city itself. When you think about it that way, it's really a dramatic change in what, you know, given the broader scope of human history, is not a long time. And so what I want to do is talk about the significance of Anchorage in relation to things personal, things regional, things national, and things international. Okay, so let's start with the personal significance of this place in 1915. Many of us know that, you know, Anchorage begins as a government operation, right? The government wants to build a railroad. So far as I know, other than the railroad and the Panama Canal, this was the first time that the government got into the railroad business, and that was a little controversial at the time. And as I think about early Anchorage, I think of it as sort of a public-private venture, where the government helps to sort of put an infrastructure into place. But if individuals don't get involved, then it's not going to work. And so there's a personal interest involved here. We have a quote from an early newspaper: Anchorage will evolve into one of the important commercial centers of Alaska. Now, that's said in June of 1915. So this is a statement of hope, a statement of faith, a statement of aspiration, right? We're not even looking at this, I don't think, at that time, right? And so some of these names will be familiar. And so these are some of the folks who come up, and they take risks. They see Anchorage as a place to invest time, invest energy, to take a risk, to pursue their own interests. And as is the case today, some businesses make it, some businesses don't. But over time, businesses take hold and a community is formed. And so we have the fellow there who sets up his humble clothing shop. And if you buy your new clothing there and then you take it to the famous waffle restaurant there and then you get syrup on it or whatever, then you can take it to the laundry shop because somebody's provided that for us. And then while you're waiting for your laundry, you can go get something at Harry Tasaki's U.S. restaurant, one of the immigrants who comes to Anchorage. And then if that food makes you sick, you can go to ZJ Lusak's pharmacy here to get some tonic. And if that makes you sick and you want to sue somebody, you can go see the lawyer, okay? And so, but all of these folks, as is the case today, are pursuing their own lives. They're pursuing their own interests. We're not talking about being selfish, but they're pursuing their own lives and their own interests. They're spending their energy. They're spending their investments. And without really thinking about it, and with nobody really directing it, they create a community. And you have the person who provides the laundry service and the restaurant service and all of these things. And so we see people pursuing their own interests and then in the process creating a community. Now here's my favorite family that I learned a lot about. And I just actually found a brand new photo that has two folks from this family yesterday at the Anchorage Museum. But this is George McCommie and then his wife and daughter Alice. I got to meet Alice a few years ago in Palmer. She was 96 at the time. George set up a tailor business, and so we established a business. And so, like others who came to Anchorage, they wanted to succeed, and in the process, they contribute to the community, and they want their children to succeed. And some of us perhaps have heard of Mary, and this is one of the people I've met in my research who most impresses me. To my knowledge, showed up at Anchorage School not speaking English, graduates valedictorian, then goes to the University at Fairbanks, graduates at the top of her class, then goes to university in the East Coast, and her son, named Pete Rouse, last I knew, was an advisor to the president. That's quite a trajectory, from showing up in school not knowing the language to your son being an advisor in the White House. And I doubt that George and Minnie had that particularly in mind when they came to Anchorage and they wanted their kids to succeed the way parents do. But that's an example of how folks come to this place and they're pursuing their interests, and they're investing their time and their resources. And in the process, they help to create a community, and they give that community things to brag about, right? And Mary's someone I think of in that way. So, and then, of course, I had up here earlier ZJ Lusak, obviously a big philanthropist here in town. So Anchorage's beginning was important to individuals because it presented them with new opportunities. And I think this is where most people are living. They're not thinking of big strategy. They're not thinking of the American empire. They're thinking about how am I going to spend tomorrow, all right? But in the process of doing that, they help to create a community that sticks. So let's turn to regional interest. What's the regional interest of this new place? And here let's focus on resources. And so we have this quote here, Anchorage enjoys the distinction of being the starting point for a great new enterprise, and then you'll notice that the quote then refers to mining and agriculture. And of course, going back to 1867, when Secretary of State William Seward made his argument for the purchase of Alaska, much of his argument was based on resources. And so I have given you a list of some of the things that he mentioned: salmon, cod, coal, gold, etc. And that sticks. And so you get articles like this. This is from April 1915. This is an article printed in many papers in the country. We won't look at it in detail, but it says, now I don't know if these top two things are true. It says that Alaska has more gold than California. I don't know if that's, does anybody know if that's the case? I don't know if that's the case or not. More coal than Pennsylvania. You can see there are a number of things that are listed. It says 470 times the size of Rhode Island. I did Google that and came up with 425, but I don't think it matters that much, right? But this sort of thing still goes on. So finish the sentence for me here. Alaska is a really big state. It's more than twice the size of? Right, okay, so the same sort of thing is going on. The way we talk and think about Alaska has a lot to do with the bigness and the resources. And it looks like Congress was on board. This is a pretty good vote. This would be news if we got this sort of agreement in the House of Representatives these days. Rounded up to 73%. And so one of the things this means then, you know, for those of us who are thinking about it, is that it seems like finally the government is taking Alaska seriously. And here I want to digress briefly. What this might mean to us in 1915 is that the whole Seward's Folly mess now we can finally put this behind us. But you notice that I have in parentheses there the myth of, because I've concluded that the whole Seward's Folly story, it's not actually right. But I think most of us are familiar with the story. And in fact, as I was looking through some archival materials today at the archives at the university, I, you know, once again came across the story. And, you know, I also found it recently here in this book from 1883. And so we know the story, right? Seward wants to buy Alaska, but then he's met with an outburst of newspaper condemnation. He's met with a storm of opprobrium, but, you know, he boldly faces the scorn and pushes on. And the thing is that there's actually very little evidence for this. There are some quotes that you can find, and if you track it, you'll find that these quotes are repeated over and over and over again. But if you actually go back and look at the newspapers from the time, you'll find that the majority opinion is in favor. It's not that people know very much about Alaska, but they do know some things about Alaska. They know that the Russians have been trading, you know, from their colony in present-day Alaska. They know that there are resources there. And then once again, I'll point you to the vote in Congress. Here's the Senate, 95% in favor, right? In the House, 70% in favor. There's some controversy, and you have some quotes from some Congress people who are opposed to this, but these are pretty good numbers. I mean, to have these sorts of votes in Congress today, we would say, well, I mean, this is as close to unanimity as you get. And so there are some well-known quotes that mock the idea of purchasing Alaska, but that's not the actual story. And my hypothesis about this is that the Seward's Folly story doesn't really tell us much about the purchase of Alaska. What it tells us about is how Alaskans felt. They were quite understandably befuddled, and you come across this just constantly in the literature. We live in a treasure trove up here, and it seems like the government is doing nothing, right? And it just doesn't make sense. And you read this sort of thing over and over again. My hypothesis is that what happens is that folks feel this way, and then they go back then, and there are these few quotes that they then interpret as the major story. Does that make sense? And so my hypothesis is that what the Seward's Folly story represents is Alaskans reading into history their frustration with the government that seemed uninterested in developing Alaska's tremendous natural wealth. And then the story gets repeated over and over again. And I think despite, you know, I mean, you can make this argument over and over, I think the story will stick because it's a great story, right? And at some point, you just like the story more than, you know, the real case. But to get back to this, I think what this means, though, for some folks on the ground, not that they're necessarily making this connection, but I think what the founding of Anchorage means for some people is this sense that finally the government's paying attention to this incredible treasure trove up here in Alaska. And so we get these sorts of quotes from a newspaper, July 1915. We're right in the center of the hub. I mean, that comes out to be more true than this writer could ever know, right? Coal, fish, once again, we refer to the resources. Everything is coming to Anchorage, that favored town situated amidst the most wonderful resources of Alaska. And so, Anchorage is beginning for individuals. It's a place to invest your time and your energy and make a better life for yourself, and in the process, create a community. Anchorage's beginning was important regionally because it suggested the territory was going to be developed, and this meant the end of a perceived national neglect. What about national interest? Let's focus here on coal, and I think many of us know that Anchorage began very much with coal in mind. So we go back to Seward, and just to a brief excerpt from a speech he gave, and among the many things he mentions is coal. He mentions that there's coal in the Cook Inlet region. This book, which I'm reading right now, it's about 450 pages, and about 300 pages is related one way or another to discussing the resources in Alaska, right? And it was published in 1913, so around the time we're discussing, refers to the coal. And although coal is controversial today, it's not so controversial at this time. When the economy depends on it, it's true that the economy is changing and that some things are moving to oil. But still, coal is vital. Just as a quick example, in 1902, 1903, if I remember correctly, there was a coal strike. And President Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, got involved because this was a threat to the economy. It was also a threat to people's lives because winter's coming, and this is how they keep themselves warm. So coal at this time in the United States is not a controversial issue. What we want is more of it, and we want more of it under the American flag. Now, I know that coal is not a major export today from Alaska, but from what I've gathered up at UAF, the University of Fairbanks, Fort Wainwright, and then at the air base up in Fairbanks, my understanding is that they still get some of their heat from coal. So come January, they can tell us about, you know, the benefits of this source of energy. This was the point of view expressed at the time. Coal is essential to industry and personal comfort. And so this is why, you know, ask yourself a question, why would the editor of the Dallas Morning News publish a long article, not just a little blurb, but a long article about coal in Alaska? Why would people in Dallas care about coal in Alaska? I'm not sure that they care about coal in Alaska, but they care about coal. And if there's coal under the American flag in Alaska, we're interested in that because it's very much related to the economy and it's related to the comforts of life. And so you have a long article in the Dallas Morning News, which actually I've cut a bit out here, about coal in Alaska. There's something else related to coal, and that is that the United States is a rising power. And although most of Britain's coal exports is going towards Europe, you do have some coal being exported to the United States. The United States is a growing power, and there is an increasing desire for what we might call energy independence. The less we have to rely on foreign countries for our energy, the less we have to rely on the British Empire for our energy, then the better off we'll be. So we want more coal, and we want more coal under the American flag, right? Energy independence. They didn't use that term, but that's something that we've heard. And the United States is a growing power and wants to be more independent from other countries. Now, this expresses itself one way down in Cordova, and some of us might know about this, sort of a brief reenactment of the Boston Tea Party down in Cordova, where quite understandably, people in Cordova are wondering, why in the world are we importing coal from British Columbia when we have so much coal in Alaska, right? Which is a good question. And there's something else. Why are we relying on coal from the British Empire, right, when we could use coal under the American flag? And so there's a brief flurry of articles about what these folks in Cordova do, chucking all this British Columbian coal into the sea. But they do get the government's attention. And perhaps in a small way, this helps to further the conversation in Washington, D.C. And so this article here from June 5th, 1915, notice Anchorage there, so the name's in place right at the beginning. And how does the article begin? This is the first editorial piece about Anchorage. What's the very first sentence related to coal? Anchorage, the coal terminal for the Matanuska coal fields, etc. So this is hugely important nationally, locally, to the people involved personally. So Anchorage's beginning is important to individuals, it's important to the region, it's important nationally, because Alaska had natural resources that would help to make the U.S. wealthier and more self-sufficient. Are people on the streets talking about this so much? Probably not very much, but some are aware of it. And certainly people outside are talking this way. Not that many, but people who are in the know who are aware of what's going on.
You're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Professor of History at John Brown University, Dr. Preston Jones. His presentation, Anchorage in 1915, Its Founding and Significance to the World, was recorded on July 9th at the Anchorage Museum and was hosted by the Cook Inlet Historical Society. PowerPoint slides are referenced throughout the presentation, which we provided a link to on our website, alaskapublic.org.
Let's come to international interest. What does this little place have to do with the bigger picture? And so we come once again to this map. And this is, as I told you, this is sort of what I carry around in my head when I read about Alaska. I read about Alaska, but I also read about the Philippines, and I read about Hawaii, and recently I was reading about the Panama Canal. What's the connection? So we go back to Seward, and he noted at the beginning, another thing Alaska brings to the table, so to say, is trade with East Asia, which has been the prize from the 1500s, right? And still is, right? Trade with East Asia is still a big question. And Seward says, look, we've got to get into trade with China, got to get into trade with this rising power, Japan. I mean, just a new power at this time in 1867, but it's clear from the beginning, Japan is a rising power. We want to trade. And so Seward mentions this. In this case, he was referring to trading fur with China. But this is part of the world as he sees it. As folks think about the United States and this empire that the United States has acquired, starting in 1867 with the purchase of Alaska, but then really accelerating in 1898, people see the big picture. And so here's just a brief quote, where this fellow's talking about the possessions under the American flag. He refers to Alaska, and then Puerto Rico out in the Atlantic, and then the Philippines. And this is a vision that folks have. Alaska fits into this broad vision. You get these sorts of images. Just a few years before Anchorage is founded, here's Alaska in the middle, big gold nugget. And Alaska is acting as the intermediary between the United States and East Asia. And if you look at the map, that makes obvious sense with the Aleutian chain going out. In this case, we have Alaska serving as sort of a platform that connects the United States with much of the rest of the world. Now, in 1909, this is just the stuff, well, not completely. I mean, you have trade going on, but this is the stuff of hope, the stuff of faith, right? The stuff of aspiration. We get the picture. I pulled this from a newspaper. You see Dutch Harbor up there, linked to trade with Japan, Hawaii, San Francisco. We could also add the Panama Canal. You could add Samoa and the Philippines. It's a complicated picture out here. Here's a quote from a congressman. He says, Alaska is defended by Hawaii. And then I would add, and the congressman would know, Hawaii is defended by the Navy, and the Navy needs coal. And there's coal in Alaska, let's build a railroad in Alaska, and the headquarters will be in Anchorage. And that's how I connect, that's why I called that book City for Empire, linking Anchorage to this big Pacific empire that the U.S. has. It's not just about coal. I mean, coal is about the economy, it's about quality of life, it's about the Navy. The Navy is about commerce. The Navy is about the projection of American power. The Navy is about defense of American interests. And so Anchorage, the founding of Anchorage then, does have that big significance there. And so we won't talk about the background of these two cartoons, but in this case you have planet Earth looking on as President McKinley's making a decision about the Philippines. And in this case you have Japan, Britain, and I think the third one would be France, wondering what Uncle Sam's going to do in relation to Hawaii. And I don't think that very many people in the world you know, the wide world, are paying attention to what's happening in Anchorage. But they are paying attention to what's happening in the Pacific. And they can see that you have a few empires out there, the French, the British. You can also see that you have two other empires on the rise, Japan and the United States. And some will know that this development in Anchorage, in Alaska, is related. The only occasion I've found where a newspaper in 1915 here in Anchorage refers to another editor coming to Anchorage to look around refers to a Japanese newspaper. And so on the one hand, it may not be a big deal, but on the other hand, it's at least worth noticing that the editor of this newspaper thought it was worth reporting that we had an editor from a Japanese newspaper here looking around. And it could just be interest. I don't know if there's a backstory there. But clearly the world can see that the U.S. is a power on the rise in the Pacific. Japan is clearly a power on the rise in the Pacific. And of course we know where that goes as these powers eventually end up clashing. And so, coal, and we're thinking primarily of using that coal for the Navy. And the Navy we associate with commerce, the Navy we associate with projection of American power, with defense, with imperial rivalry out there in the Pacific. And so we have a congressman here who says, for naval purposes alone, construction of a railroad in Alaska is fully justified. And then that railroad will be headquartered in Anchorage. So there is that broader significance there. And so here's one of the lofty sort of quotes you get, you know, this early 20th century writing. Like a queen on her throne, Anchorage rests on the shore, her railroad and her steamship lines extending as two arms filled. Now this is 1917. Again, this is the stuff of hope, right? But folks are investing their time and their energy to make this work. And it doesn't always work. You know, as many of us know, there are a lot of towns that come and go here in Alaska. And there are some folks in other towns who are hoping that Anchorage will go because they see Anchorage as a rival. Down in Seward, they see Anchorage, many folks down there see Anchorage as a rival. But Anchorage obviously sticks. And so the two arms are filled to overflowing, what? With the abundance of the world's commerce and industry. This is the cosmic importance of this place. So Anchorage's beginning was important for individuals, for the region, for the nation. It has international significance as well. It gives the U.S. another platform on the Pacific from which to trade and project American power. So here's a quote that I like. Anchorage should in time become a great industrial city. Once again, it's sort of an aspirational statement, but there is a little element of realism here where it says in time. Anchorage should in time. And so, as we know, as many of us know, there were some significant disappointments. Anchorage was born when much of the world was at war. And that war begins in 1914. The United States itself will get into that war in April of 1917. And young men leave Anchorage, and they leave Alaska in big numbers. Or they leave Alaska to go to join the military. Some women will leave as well to work with the Red Cross. Also, I saw an article about a young woman here from Anchorage who joined the Navy. Right? So folks will leave to serve in the military. They'll also leave to work in industry outside. Many of the ships that were involved in the Alaska trade are now diverted to the war effort. And so the depression that begins in the United States in 1929, I think it's safe to say it begins in Alaska really about 1918. Alaska deals with a couple decades of economic depression. And the sense that I have, perhaps some of you have a different sense, but the sense that I have is that when the depression hits nationally, it doesn't make a huge difference because much of Alaska, if not all of it, is already in a state of economic depression. So this is a significant disappointment. And then it turns out that the coal isn't actually useful for the Navy. And some folks were saying this, they had been saying this for years, but it becomes clear in time. So these are disappointments. And so things are sort of put on hold for a while. But then there's the external jolt. And just as cities outside Los Angeles, San Diego gain tremendous importance during the Second World War, The same is true, as we know, of Anchorage. And so we have the famous, or the well-known, hit at Pearl Harbor in December. And then folks outside don't know so much, but folks in Alaska, I think, know that Dutch Harbor here in Alaska is also raided from the sky. Attu on the Aleutian chain is occupied. And we know that Anchorage becomes very important. And so here they come. Here come the soldiers and those with the Army Air Corps. And slowly but surely, the city grows. Or actually, it's pretty dramatic growth. And so Anchorage should, in time, become a great industrial city. It does take some time. There is that pause, that 20-year pause or so. But it does work out. And so let's just review as we begin to wind down. At the beginning, the place was important for personal reasons. People want to get on with their lives. They want to succeed. They want to provide for their children. And we gave some examples. And as was the case at the beginning, you know, you can look at the court records. There were problems from the beginning. You know, wherever you have more than one human being in one place, eventually there will be some sort of conflict or something and problems, and then we're conflicted within ourselves as individuals. But so Anchorage never was a paradise. I don't know if that's possible on this planet. And the same is true today. There are problems, there are challenges, there are difficulties. But it seems to me that most people are doing pretty much the same thing. They're carrying on with their lives. They're pursuing their interests. We have, I think, 2 marathons here in Anchorage, don't we? So some of us are interested in that, some of us aren't. But people are running marathons, or they're pursuing their interests as tourists, or they're in those office buildings pursuing their interests in office politics and all of that. But, you know, they're pursuing their interests, and they're pursuing their careers and so on. And then there's Jitter's Cafe in Eagle River, where I spend a lot of time. And so then there's the regional interest. I don't think folks at the beginning could have known how true that would be. I mean, they looked for Anchorage to be an important regional place, but I don't think they could know that Anchorage would be absolutely essential, crucial, central to the economy of Alaska. There's a national interest. Of course, the interest in coal and the natural resources there. There's some coal is still exported out of Seward. But I just looked some things up. I didn't know this before. In terms of weight landed, Anchorage's airport is the second busiest air cargo site in the U.S. I don't think most Americans know that. That's a significant contribution to the country's economy. Although oil production has declined, I think everyone would say that what Alaska produces still is important to the country. And so Alaska is important nationally. I think also, you know, all of the TV shows about Alaska and sort of the place Alaska inhabits in the American mind generally, that's sort of a contribution. Whatever that is, I'll let somebody else spell that out. But Alaska plays an important role, and of course Anchorage accounts for much of Alaska. And then there's the international connection. And so we envisioned back in 1909 and earlier, Seward, way back in 1867, Alaska connecting the United States to Asia. Well, that's true. I think Alaska's greatest foreign trading partners are Japan, China, South Korea, right? I think I just saw China just recently came into first place. That's absolutely panned out. Many countries receive exports from Alaska, and these exports, many of them, I think probably the great majority, come through Anchorage. So that has absolutely panned out. And I know that there's recent news about cuts at the base here, but I think everyone would still recognize the tremendous role Anchorage, Alaska and Anchorage play in terms of this old theme of the projection of American power and the defense of American interests. And so when the Russian planes come close to American airspace, up go the planes from the base here in Anchorage. Whenever we see these planes flying over Anchorage, right, the jets or the cargo planes from the Air Force or the helicopters, just think of the incredible power that those things represent. And the folks who were here 100 years ago, as they thought about the projection of power, thought primarily of the Navy. They couldn't have imagined this sort of technology, let alone that kind of power. But just as in, you know, is the case in the other themes, this turns out to be more true than they could have known, that this place would become a place where American power and the defense of its interests would be very much based. And then there's the memorial here, not far from here, where we see that folks go from Alaska, serving their country overseas. And then, as I think the mayor referred to this at the beginning, as you know, we're hearing a lot about East Asia, about the South China Sea. I think here in Alaska, there's also consciousness of the potential tensions up in the Arctic. And I think we'll see where this goes, but as time goes, I think Americans might find, folks on the outside, might find out more and more the importance of this place. And so, personal interests, yes, then and now. Regional interests, more now than the folks at the beginning could have imagined. National interests, no question about it. International interests, no question about it. And so Anchorage should in time become a great industrial city, a great and mighty northern empire, is just in the opening, says the Weekly Alaskan here in Anchorage, in June 1916. So a little bit further from where we are now. And perhaps that's a bit of an overstatement, this one, but not too much. I think it's pretty impressive in 100 years' time. So thank you.
Here, the speaker fielded questions from the audience, from which we've chosen just two to include. First, fellow Alaska historian Katie Ringsmith asks whether Dr. Jones can comment on the role historic interpretations play in everyday life in Alaska.
Well, it's interesting. So the question is, if I can paraphrase it, the importance of history in sort of shaping us, you know, community-mindedness or a sense of awareness. And you mentioned some of the stories or the myths that persist, and thinking perhaps of the Seward's Folly one, that even though there's not a lot of evidence for it, it persists. Well, let me put it this way. I mean, obviously in Arkansas, there's not a huge demand for the history of Alaska, right? And so, you know, this is actually only the third time in 12 years that I've spoken publicly about Alaska, because you just don't get to do it very much in Arkansas. But I do bring Alaska a lot into my lectures, and I bring it in the sense of, here's how I do it, and folks will have different ways of going at it. But for example, I'll talk about the current events and the question of China and the South China Sea and, you know, all of the stuff that's coming out regularly about the news. And I relate that to a big question: who's going to be the big dog in the Pacific, right? And that question has been on the table for a long time. And from 1945 until recently, the question seemed to be resolved. The United States will be the big dog in the Pacific, and I think the U.S. still is, but perhaps we're in a time of transition now. And then I tell my students, look, let's go back and see how this story's been playing out for a very long time. And that's where I'll bring Alaska into it and show them some of these quotes and show them how folks thought of Alaska in the context. I don't know if I answered your question well. I think in terms of shaping outlook and sentiment and so on, perhaps the one thing all teachers can do, and history teachers can do as well, is to promote thoughtfulness and the ability to resist simplification, right? I don't know if this is helpful at all, but I appreciate your point. Did I kind of touch a little bit on your point?
Let's have one more.
Next, an audience member asked the speaker to comment on whether Alaska will one day have more control as a state and not be treated by the federal government as a, quote, stepchild.
Well, and that's an image that's used a lot in the, I just read, actually today, I think, again in the archives over at UAA, I read a poem about, you know, Alaska's the orphan that's, you know, left in the lurch and all that. And so the question is, you know, so for example, Anchorage is really started as a government project. Now, I don't, you know, that's obviously true. I think we also have to notice, though, the individuals who come, and so I think we see a joint venture. But the question is, do I see a time in the future when Alaskans will sort of more stand on their own and not be so reliant on government? Is that kind of the point, the question? You know, I guess I don't know enough. I don't have enough street knowledge to give a to give a good answer to that. I have noticed a paradox of Alaska history, and I don't know, Katie, maybe you've noticed this as well. And actually, you do see it at the very beginning in Anchorage. On the one hand, we want government to do a lot of stuff, but on the other hand, we hate it when government does stuff because it's complicated and bureaucratic. And so we want government, we want more government, but we don't. But we hate the government, right? And so there's this paradox that I think has perhaps become, I don't know, it seems to be pretty persistent. Now, I do want to say, if I could just add one other point. I'm not super political, right? But I was thinking that, you know, early Anchorage is not friendly necessarily to libertarianism, right? Because it is a sort of a government entity that the government gets it going. But on the other hand, I mean, there was a socialist movement here early on, but that didn't really succeed either. And so what we see here in early Anchorage is a kind of a partnership, and maybe if I had the chance to teach this, maybe that's how I would go at it. Here's an example of, you know, a kind of public-private partnership where you don't have sort of a libertarian free-for-all, but neither do you have, you know, a government that is stamping out people's ambitions. I mean, people are free to be entrepreneurial and to pursue their interests in that kind of way. It's not really a direct answer to your question. I don't know where things will go. I mean, my understanding is that a lot of the state's under the government's control, right? And then obviously with the military and so on. So I can't really give you an answer. Those are just sort of my musings in response. Great. Yeah. Permanent fund checks, yeah.
Please, everyone, thank Preston for his help.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Professor of History at John Brown University, Dr. Preston Jones. His presentation, Anchorage in 1915, Its Founding and Significance to the World, was recorded on July 9th at the Anchorage Museum and was hosted by the Cook Inlet Historical Society. PowerPoint slides were referenced throughout the presentation, which we provided a link to on our website, alaskapublic.org. Thanks for tuning in with us today on Addressing Alaskans. Until next week, I'm your host and producer, Evan Erickson.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.